Jam-packed edition of Hoops 360. VP of the WNBPA, Nafisa Collier, joins the show. Plus, Cass deep dives into her mock selection experience and makes us all so much smarter about the NCAA tournament selection process. Don't miss it. What is up, everybody? Welcome into Hoops 360. On today's edition of the show, Vice President of the WNBPA, co-founder of Unrivaled, and WNBA forward, yep, you guessed it, Nafisa Collier joins the show. So we will get all of Fee's thoughts and her perspective on the WNBA CBA negotiations from the player side of things. Plus, Cass fills us in on everything that we need to know about the March Madness selection process. So let's get into it. Cass, lovely to see you. We were talking about how excited we were to talk about college hoops today, which of course we will. And then we got some WNBA CBA updates. So we start today's show how we normally do, or how it has become so familiar to us to start all of our shows with, and that is an update on the CBA negotiations. So on Tuesday, it was reported that the WNBPA submitted a counter proposal to the league that said, according to a source, the WNBPA is asking for an average of 27.5% of gross revenue over the course of the agreement, including 25% in the first year. The union is also asking for less than a $9.5 million salary cap. The union also proposed that the teams continue to provide housing. Housing has been a big point of contention in some of these negotiations to players in the first several years of their new agreement, but not later on, as long as players are making close to the collectively bargained max salary. Cass, what does it all mean?
Could mean a lot of things. You know, I think, first of all, when you're talking about the gross revenue, it is positive that there is some budging and the leaks are coming out about what the budgets are. I believe the union was at around 31% in their last proposal. So they dropped it down a few percentage points from the league perspective. That's not enough. They're pretty far away on what the percentage is. So on the one hand, you could say it means that we're closer to a deal because there's some negotiating actually going on after that standoff. On the flip side of things, you could say we're not really closer to a deal because there is that huge gap between the sides. I think the housing aspect is interesting, too. As you mentioned, that has become a very big talking point. The league, from their perspective, when they had sent their proposal maybe about a week ago now, they did put in stipulations for certain types of players to receive housing. From the union perspective, though, I do think it is a good point that, for example, if the CBA were to be signed tomorrow, it's a very quick turnaround for some of these players. Even if you do have a max contract or about to sign, you know, $1 million deal, like, you have to find a place to live. So I think that's actually probably the more interesting point, that there should be maybe some sort of grace period for housing if it is in the CBA that only certain players receive it.
It makes sense. It does. But, you know, when the question is, what does it mean? Honestly, I think it's okay to say, I don't know. At this, that's kind of where I fall. I don't know. We'll see. And if you're a WNBA fan that's grown frustrated by this entire process, how long it's been drawn out, the fact that it's been, you know, very public back and forth between the Players Association and the league, I don't blame you. I think I'm getting to that point as well. And I think it's frustration matched with anxiety looking up at the date. It's February 18th. You know, we've got some pretty important dates that are coming up in the WNBA calendar, and a very packed one at that. There's not a lot of wiggle room.
Adam Silver. It'd be very funny if Adam Sandler chimed in on this, though.
What did he have to say about all of this?
We have a movie waiting this weekend with Adam Sandler in it. Adam Silver pointed out the obvious here, that we're in the 11th hour. It feels like we've been in the 11th hour for a little bit. Like, it's about to strike midnight, it feels like.
And it doesn't seem like it's getting any closer, at least just based off of the WNBA statement. They, in response to the counterproposal, the WNBA said, quote, "The Players Association's latest proposal remains unrealistic and would cause hundreds of millions of dollars of losses for our teams. We still need to complete two drafts and free agency before the start of training camp, and we are running out of time." They feel it. We feel it as fans. Are the players feeling it? We'll talk to Nafisa Collier here in a little bit here on the show, so stick around. Joining us now here on Hoops 360 on behalf of Icy Hot, the official recovery partner of Unrivaled, is five-time WNBA All-Star and Unrivaled co-founder Nafisa Collier. Nafisa, you are joining us on behalf of Icy Hot. I totally want to get into that. But it's been a wild and, you know, overwhelming, I'm sure, season and Unrivaled for you. You have the tour stop in Philly. You'll have, you know, a stop in Brooklyn as well. We just had the one-on-one tournament. So much growth for this league. If you could kind of take a step back and evaluate where you are right now, how would you describe the growth of the league and then maybe what's left to come?
Just the growth of the league, just the, you know, we were able to add two new teams this year, which obviously gives more roster spots and more room for more players to come in. And that's just due to like the impact that the players are having on people and how much people are really enjoying the product, which is amazing to see. And the fact that we were able to go to Philly and have a record night like that, the atmosphere is unbelievable. I've never felt anything like that before. So I'm really glad that we get to extend that because of the success of Philly to Brooklyn for our semifinals. So it's just been kind of a whirlwind year, but really exciting. And I'm excited to continue it next year with even more tour stops. So it's going to be really fun.
On the CBA, hitting crunch time, time is running out. Adam Silver talked about the 11th hour. With everyone being in Unrivaled, I know you can all speak with each other, and that's really helpful. But I'm just wondering what conversations you've had with maybe that middle tier of player in terms of moving forward, and if there is a deal to be done, or if you do need to end up striking.
Like how they feel about it, you're asking? How the middle tier feels about that?
Yeah, how they feel or how they're preparing or any conversation you've had with them about it.
Well, for the past, I would say, like year and a half, the executive committee has been urging everyone to save their money because we knew the negotiations were coming up. We never know what's going to happen. You know, if there's not a season, we want to make sure everyone's prepared. So hopefully everyone has been doing that. That's something we've been talking about for a really long time. But also that is something that we check in with everyone, you know, because opinions change over time. And that is something that has stayed consistent, that people, no matter, you know, middle tier, the one like the people at the top, rookies, everyone has been really consistent in that we want a season to happen. But if we don't get the things that we are wanting to stay 10 toes down on, then we're going to sit out for as long as that takes. Like, that's not what anyone wants, but it's what we're willing to do in order to get the things that we feel are fair.
How do you feel about where things stand right now?
I think that things are moving. Like, we are not where we want to be, but I think negotiations are trending in the right direction. And that's what you want. You want movement. You don't want to be in a stalemate. You want there to be hope for the future. And I do have that. I think there has to be a lot of movement in some, you know, in a lot of places in the CBA. But the fact that we are moving, I think, is really hopeful.
She is the VP of the WNBPA. She's a five-time WNBA All-Star and Unrivaled co-founder, Nafisa Collier. Nafisa, thank you so much for your time today and really appreciate you stopping by the show.
Thanks, Fee.
Thank you.
Appreciate Nafisa Collier for stopping by here on the show, but let's transition into college hoops of it all. Like I said, looking at the calendar, scary time for the WNBA at February 18th, but an exciting time in the college hoops calendar as we are just a couple weeks away from tournament time. Cass, you just returned from a mock selection. Give us the whole background. Just I get smarter every time I talk to Cass. I feel so much smarter after everything that you filled me in on from your experience. So tell me all about it. What happened? What was going on behind the scenes?
Yes, we are smarter because of the NCAA in this case. I was just the conduit of it. But on Thursday, the NCAA Women's Basketball Committee hosted a group of us, some reporters, broadcasters, some conference personnel, and we served as the committee for a day. We did a mock selection. We learned exactly how it's done, the technology, how they actually select teams, how they seed those teams, how they bracket those teams. For us, it was about an 8-hour day. And I have a diary up about that, kind of detailing it throughout and what it was. For the selection committee, though, it's from Wednesday to Sunday before selection Sunday. And I think what was really interesting to me that really puts it into perspective is this is a months-long process, even leading up to right now. They're in constant communication. They speak with coaches. They speak with conferences. They are all tasked with different conferences where they're the primary and the secondary so that they can take in all this information and share it with the entire committee. It was a really eye-opening day. You know, I had told some of you, I knew the principles. I know how to seed. I know how the bracket works. I know what the rules are, like all those nitty-gritty kind of things. But it's completely different to sit in the room and go through it and see this kind of labor-intensive task of making sure that you have a bracket you can be proud of and you can back up in a way when it's, you know, maybe not called out, but like there's always some interesting aspects of a bracket.
It, no doubt. And I have long said about, you know, the college basketball selection committee, college football selection committee, I don't ever want that to be my job. I'm not envious of anyone who is tasked with doing what feels like the near impossible. But just after hearing about your experience, I feel even stronger in that take that I am not envious of anybody who has to make these decisions for real. So I know that you have so many tidbits and takeaways from your experience. But what would you say was your biggest takeaway from getting to sit in the chairs of the selection committee?
The biggest takeaway, there were a few big takeaways. The big one I just mentioned was like, this is very labor intensive. When they're in the room, if you say something, everyone, you say it to everyone. There are no side conversations, anything like that. Everyone has all of the information possible. The second big thing, though, was exactly how you put teams into the field. So our kind of homework, if you will, was to, we had a sheet, which we'll put up here on a graphic, but we chose up to 24 teams that were our at-large teams, teams that we think should definitely be in the field. And then we ranked at least the top 30 teams, and we could add more, you know, up to 37. There's 37 at-large bids, bubble teams, et cetera. And so I sat there in the days leading up to it, because I'm this kind of person, and I'm like, ah, like, this is so hard. And I'm sitting there trying to list the 30 best teams. And first of all, I'm an AP voter, but this was just different. It was different than having to do my AP ballot every week. I would get to like the 25th team, even the 20th team. And I'm like, how do I differentiate these teams? Like, this is so hard. Like, how are we going to do this? This is crazy. I give up. When you go into the mock selection, after you go through all of this, the first section is obviously we're going to select teams. And so selecting teams is the body of work. There's criteria that go into it. And all of this is available. As we said, I wrote a little diary, but also the NCAA makes sure that everyone knows this. They want to be transparent about the process. But what we did was I like paper, so I filled mine out on paper. But then in the computer that we were provided, you submit your at-large teams, you submit under consideration. There's a certain kind of mathematical number that puts certain teams into the field. And you keep doing this, you keep doing this. Now, to seed your teams, which is kind of what have they done lately kind of deal, like how are they playing right now, we would vote the top eight teams or eight teams that should definitely be in the field. Whatever the math is, which you can look at online, they move into a field. And you kind of keep going 8x4, 4x4 to get all your teams in and then to seed them. So for example, let's talk about the one line. We have these teams in a field. And the next thing is, okay, every ballot is private. You're going to submit a ballot for the eight teams you think should be on the one line. Vote, teams get across. Okay, you are going to rank these teams 1 through 4. We rank whatever the consensus is, that's what it is. Then the chair says, is everyone good with this? Are we happy? Do we like this? And you talk it out. One of the conversations we had was at the time, this was before Texas's loss to Vanderbilt, let's be clear, there were some of us, me included in the room, who thought Texas had a case for the number three seed. If this were the actual committee, we could have had just a vote to say, is Texas number three or is South Carolina number three? You secretly vote, gets across, whatever. I think it what really came across, the kind of last big takeaway, is to do the seeding correctly, you really need to like voice your opinion and be sure and talk everything out. Because when the seeding is done, you can't then go to the bracketing and say, oh, well, if Texas were the three seed, like it could have gone to Fort Worth and that'd be great for fan attendance. Or, you know, this team deserves to host a game. Like they have that resume, but are they a top 16 seed? Are they the 16 best? Because you can't keep going back and forth. There are policies and principles you go through to make the most fair true seed list and then to make the most fair bracket. And they're two very different things.
You know, when you said like talking it through is so important. One thing, you know, when we were discussing the podcast, discussing some of your takeaways off air, you mentioned how you were having just a side conversation with somebody at lunch, just chit-chatting about the season. And somebody from the NCAA was like, oh, wait, Cass, like, what were you saying? Do you want to share that with everybody? Like, there are checks and balances in place to make sure that people are not having side conversations that the entirety of the group is involved with. So it does seem like, at least from your experience, there is a ton of attention paid to making sure that there is a sanctity to this process.
Yes, integrity was used a lot. Checks and balances was used. It's this idea of, you know, obviously, like, we're a mock selection committee. A lot of us knew each other. Like, I knew the person sitting next to me. We were just, like, chatting in the dark times about, oh, is this team good? But if we were the selection, you know, group, like, us talking about if a team is good, there's something we might say that someone across the room is like, oh, I'm thinking differently about that now. And so when they first start discussing teams, there are so many inputs that they have. They, as we said, talk to coaches, all these things. Like, every piece of information is important. You know, when you and I were talking, there was a winter storm that came through the South. How does that impact a team? You look at a team like Ole Miss and Tennessee that played this week. That was slammed into the middle of their schedules, right? It was rescheduled from a couple of weeks ago. They're now playing like Ole Miss has like four games in 7 days, something wild like that. Like, that impacts a result and you have to take it into consideration. So you're also not allowed to talk at like dinner or anything like that. And for these committee members, they always have access to the way that things are organized by the NCAA, you know, things we were shown to have an understanding and to always, not always, but like you're often thinking about what it means in terms of seating and resumes and whatnot.
I think another thing that's fascinating, you know, hearing your takeaways is we as fans, myself included, the lines between ranking and seating is so blurred. I'm like, oh, well, that's like, that's a three seed. But that's not how you can look at it from the perspective of the selection committee. The differences between ranking, seeding, and bracketing are because it's not just one big thing. It's not just, okay, here are our rankings. Here's a Mod Podge of it. Here's your bracket. Here you go. It's all of the consideration of ranking first, seeding second, and then bracketing and kind of mapping out the path for a lot of these teams in the large, you know, field of 64.
Yeah, you have to select your field. And I will also say in our mock selection, we kind of ignored automatic qualifiers. When it comes to that, they have a lot of different drafts as they go along that final week, like depending on who automatically qualifies. We left that out. This is a mock selection, everyone. But yeah, like to select the teams and then to seed the teams and then to bracket the teams, they can and do occur simultaneously. And one of the things we were told was like those days that they're there, maybe they go back and they say, okay, are we still feeling good about the one line? And when you're voting teams into these fields, you can also have a vote to pull them out. There was at one point, I think we had like, you know, our top 18 or something, or 16, I guess, because we're going kind of by fours and eights. And it was like, okay, does anyone have a team that they really feel like should have been in the top 16? And if someone did, you know, I think Michigan State should have. Okay, we'll talk about it. Like, do they have the resume, what have you? And if we wanted, if the chair wanted, you can then have a vote to change things kind of one by one. And as they get to the end, it gets smaller. So maybe you vote in two teams and then you vote in one by one. Like, everything is very intentional. There's a process for everything. I think the most interesting thing to me, kind of like I said, was thinking about it differently and knowing that it's not just 12 people coming in and like, this is my ranking, what's yours? It's very segmented. How do we get little groups of teams into the field? And then we'll do the next thing.
And that's almost how I feel like you have to. It makes it so much more palatable to go team by team, fours and eights, rather than, okay, let's look at 25 teams that are all in the bubble. The other thing, too, is you mentioned, okay, well, hypothetically, I think Michigan State should be a top 16 team. The way that you have to look at it, from what I learned from your experiences, is not just this team deserves to host. It's so easy for me to get up in front of a microphone and say, I think that they should be a host site. But that's not how that works.
It was not. That was mentioned, right? So the chair at the end, we're voting in our final to do the top 16 because we didn't do a full thing. But the chair says, okay, who are the last four you think should host? And the kind of lead for the NCAA said, hold up. This is not about hosting. Mm-hmm. We don't care about hosting. This is who do you think are the next four best teams on your board that deserve to be into the field. Has nothing to do with anything else.
That was refreshing. And I think I knew deep down that that's probably how they had to approach it, but just to hear it be so cut and dry, like, no, you cannot take that into consideration. It is, are they the 16th ranked team in the country or are they the 17th ranked team in the country? It is that simple. It is that cut and dry. The other thing that totally blew my mind. We talk about it every day. We hear commentators talking about it. We use it in resume conversation, and it is not even a consideration in resumes. Cass, you blew my mind with this.
Quad wins.
Quad wins aren't even considered.
They are not. So
what?
We finally get to talking, right? We're kind of all yearning to see this discussion in action. And we start talking about the number one overall seed. And someone says, well, it has to be UConn. This makes the most sense. I kind of throw it out there like, well, what about UCLA? Like, I want to see the discussion happen. They have 14 quad one wins. And we're kind of talking about this and what their resume might be, et cetera. And the NCAA says, but is quad one wins on your sheet? Because there's a list of criteria. And again, we can share this in full. It's in the diary. But quad one wins are not on here. Quad wins were described to us as an organizational structure, right? As you said, you and I can sit up here and say, yeah, that was a quad one win. Like, and people listening know that's huge. But all quad wins are not built the same, right? Texas defeated UCLA and South Carolina in November. Those are, I don't know, net 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever they were. It's not the same as winning versus a net 25 team or a net 40 team, you know, at kind of the bottom of that cusp. So it's easy to look
quad one.
Right. It's easy to look at the grid and they had this up, these resumes that they've designed, and they have Nitty Gritties online as well. This is public information. It's easy to look at it and use that as a differentiator when you're thinking about it, but you have to go deeper than that. And really what we ended up doing, which I think also blew your mind, was we went through the criteria one by one, listed alphabetically to kind of talk it out, right? To get this experience. We get down to regional rankings. And the Big Ten, there's five regions throughout the country. And these regions, I think it's three times a year, the coaches rank the top 20 teams within all the conferences in that region.
Yes.
The Big Ten and the Big East are in the same conference, which first of all blew all of our minds, but conference expansion, things are weird.
Like UConn and UCLA are being compared in the same region. Like, I don't know. I didn't get an A+ in geography, but I know that that's not right.
It's crazy. So this blew our minds. First of all, we were like, okay, well, what does that mean?
Yeah.
What it means is if we were the actual committee, someone would have the coaches' rankings and they would say, someone would say, okay, well, what did the coaches say about who's number one? And they would look in their notes and say, okay, well, the coaches voted X, Y better than the next team. Mm-hmm. And so we would take that into consideration, whichever team it was. It's not the end all be all, but we would consider it. And if we were close, you know, maybe we'd say, well, the coaches voted this team number one, so I guess we will too.
And sometimes, just, you know, based off of that logic, sometimes there's going to be years where you are located regionally and who you will be compared against regionally can either be a wonderful advantage or to your detriment. You know, UCLA and UConn, I mean, hands down, the two best teams in the entire country. Like, those two teams being compared, you know, head-to-head in the same region is different than maybe, say, like, a TCU, which is not going to be compared in the same region as any of those powerhouse West Coast teams, you know, the USCs, the UCLAs of the world, because they're in a different region. So that was a complete side of it that I didn't even know existed. But the quad wins was crazy to me.
That's
like quad, like, we talk about quad one wins, quad two wins. We talk about it simultaneously with resumes. Like, it is so aligned with postseason resumes, with tournament talk, that I never even questioned whether or not it was a data point. Like, we hear it in broadcasts. We hear it just in conversation. We see it written in articles. Quad one wins, quad two wins. It's synonymous with resume. So, you know, if you're, you know, out there come tournament time, the bracket comes out and you hear a friend saying, well, this team had more quad one wins than that team. No, no, no. Gotta stop. Let them know. That is not a contributing factor. Net is, and of course, quad wins are part of the net. So it's not, you know, completely thrown out. But even still, you know, we're talking about UCLA and UConn. What UCLA had on their resume that UConn doesn't is 13, I believe 13 at this point, 13 quad one wins. But UCLA is still second in the net to UConn. So net is a contributing factor, just not quad one wins. Fascinating.
Yeah. And same with, like, significant wins is on here. So who had the significant wins? You'd probably say UConn. Common opponents, competitive and losses. This is something that, you know, we're going to get into the top 16 rankings later, but this is something that became a very big talking point this weekend with that, the observable component. I will say I don't remember our mock bracket. By the end, it was a lot. There were a lot of colors flying around and errors, and there's a lot of rules.
It's okay. Blur.
I don't know. We just speed seeded, but I will say UConn was our number one. They do not, actually, this is interesting too that we didn't talk about. You do your secret vote, like, in the system, and the administrator of the committee, like, tells you. It also pops up on your screen, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, or who got in, who didn't. But you actually don't know what the vote is. So for all I know, we could have unanimously selected UConn. UConn was our number one. I think observable component was massive for us in that decision. But you don't know what the numbers are. And if you have a tiebreaker, even if it's for, like, you know, you vote four in from 12 to 16 or 13 to 16, and there's a tie at 14, 15, you vote that tie, who is 14. And you don't, I think you know that at the time, but yeah, that's the only thing you vote.
And the anonymity of the process too, I think, is important to the process to know that, like, oh, okay, like, XYZ didn't vote team ABC number two, like, let's go change their mind. Not that anybody would do that, but, like, just maintaining a certain level of integrity in this process, I think, is one of my biggest takeaways from your experience. But before we get into the top 16, because you mentioned it, UConn number one, I don't think that's any sort of breaking news. Do you feel differently about the selection process, having gone through it yourself?
I do a little bit, yeah. It feels so structured and fair in a really good way. you know, there's 12 people with so much input of information, first of all, which I love. You're not just on your own to seek out these answers. There's so much going into it. And then the secret vote, the way that you just do it in these tiny little segments, you know, you can drown in trying to rank 37 teams. But the way that it's done and knowing, you know, at every step, you're kind of, okay, do we feel good? Okay, do we like this? Okay, can we converse with this? Like, it does feel very fair by the end of it, you know, as we know. And like, it was funny because the media members in the room, sometimes we'd hit certain points and we're like, well, that's not fair. Like, why does that team get that? And they're like, but we are not thinking of it that way.
Yeah.
You know? And so the committee is going to get railed on for something. There's going to be some sort of like ridiculousness that we all see. But to be in the room and to hear from them that like, we don't think about that kind of stuff. We cannot. We are here to seed and then bracket, and it is what it is. It did feel very like sometimes things are just unfair, but they're not trying to make it that way.
That was one of my big takeaways, and I am with you that I do, just hearing your experiences, do feel like the process is more fair than I thought. Mm-hmm. Just hearing the level of attention that everything gets makes me feel like the process is much more pure than maybe we as fans want to believe that it is. Inevitably in this process, somebody is going to feel like they got screwed. Inevitably in this process, we're going to look at one team and say, oh, they got the easy draw. But mm-hmm. I don't think the selection committee hates your favorite team. And I don't think that the selection committee is showing favoritism to your team's bitter rival. Sometimes things just shake out one way or another. And it is inevitable in a tournament of this size and of this magnitude. Some people are going to get the short end of the stick and some people are going to get a pretty sweet deal. And that kind of just is what it is.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much.
Good experience, though.
Yes, I had a great time. Again, like, it's completely different to be in the room and to sit there with other people and to see it happen. Very fun.
Good. I'm glad you had a good experience. Oh, I was just like, you know, on this high after hearing of all of your takeaways. I felt like I was getting like all of the secrets. Like I was going behind the scenes and, you know, seeing all of the how the sausage is made. Like I felt like I was learning something I wasn't supposed to. Yes. But you can. You can. All of your takeaways and everything that you learned at the selection committee is available on the NCAA's website. Let's go through the top 16. Like you mentioned, UConn, number one team in the country. Any issues there? Because you did mention how UCLA was one team that you considered as potentially the number one team in the country.
Yeah, I mean, I think also an interesting note that I personally took away from being in the room was I think it's really important to consider every single option. I went in thinking UConn was the number one. I still thought UConn was the number one. I voted UConn number one. But I don't want to ignore the other teams. Yeah. UCLA, I think when it comes down to it, you know, we had said like observable component, UConn is beating the brakes off of people. Like, and I understand it's a different conference, but one of the things we also talked about was you can't ding a team for the conference that they're in, or lift them up because the conference that they're in. We felt like UConn, you know, hit all of these things and just had the better resume. And it looks like, having seen this top 16, the committee feels the same way.
Yeah, that's one thing that was highlighted on the NCAA's website is we do not take conference into account. Mm-hmm. Strength of schedule comes into account, which is also a factor of the conference that you're in. But you can't control the conference that you're in. Like, you can't control if the teams around you are good or bad. It comes down to what you can control. And UConn does get credit for scheduling difficult, competitive, top five non-conference matchups. The rest of the top five, we have UCLA at two, South Carolina at three. Not really any surprises there. Vanderbilt at four and Texas at five. That was one thing that I wanted to run by you. How much weight does head-to-head play in rankings?
That's a really good question. And that's a question that a lot of us asked about a lot of things. What it comes down to is it holds as much weight as the committee wants it to hold. I think a big thing coming out of seeing the actual committee's top 16 is one of the things that they are really weighing more than anything is significant wins. No, wait. I lost it. See, there's so many on here.
It's colors and numbers and words. It's so much stuff.
It's so much stuff. Recent success. And like if they're competitive in losses, that seems to be a big one. I think this is my personal belief, like looking at South Carolina, Vanderbilt, Texas. I think however teams finish in the SEC are going to be the 1-2-3. Kind of that high, unless something else changes. And that's just my opinion based nothing on what the committee has said.
It's a good call by you, though. And I think, you know, some people hearing that, hearing you say, well, it only has as much weight as the committee wants it to. Some people might like roll their eyes at that. There's no standardization week over week or year over year. But I think that's the beauty and also the detriment of having subjectivity in the rankings is the beauty of that is you have humans that can add context into how teams are playing now and recent success. And you can, peel back the layers of an individual team and individual's performances, but also at the same time, there is a subjectivity aspect to this that might not be consistent throughout the entirety of the entire field. And that's just, again, that's part of the process, which isn't always the most fun thing to hear if you're a fan of a team who gets left off or if you feel like you didn't get, you know, their due, because I'm sure Texas fans would be looking at that at 5. You're 2 seed. You know, that's a 2 seed versus a 1 seed, that 4 versus 5, or that 16 versus 17. That's just one ranking off, but massive when it comes to being a 1 seed or being a host site. But you can't think about those things from the perspective of the committee.
No, the margins are very close. And, you know, you had mentioned I was talking with someone else, like nothing happens in a vacuum. And so the thing we were talking about was whether you liked Vic Schaefer going off about it or not, like the fact that Texas had to play LSU and then South Carolina, both on the road, like have to take that into consideration. Does that mean you change your opinion on Texas? Like, no, not necessarily. But that's something that early on the conversation, you know, that conference leader, the person in charge of that conference, monitoring that conference might say, like, hey, Texas had a really tough road trip, had to go to LSU, had to go to South Carolina, lost both those games and move on to the next team. Just so that people know and they don't look at it and say like, oh, they lost back to back. What's going on?
Yeah. Context and nuance that matters. It's not, we don't look at every single win or loss or game or team the same way because you can't, because not every team is the same. Not everything is standardized. We've got Michigan at 6, Louisville at 7, LSU at 8, Ohio State and Duke round out the top 10. Anything from those teams that stood out to you or any of those teams that you were, you know, debating back and forth about?
Yeah, I mean, if you're talking recent success, like has to be Duke. Yeah. This is a team that we are wondering if they would even host games. They've climbed up. I don't know how much more climbing they can theoretically do. They're not going to get a ton of signature wins down the back end of the ACC schedule, but them sitting at number 10 and being a 3 seed, significant given the way their non-conference schedule went.
Yeah, and you know, look, the non-conference schedule didn't go great. We talked about that a lot here on this podcast. But again, that's the recent success as well. I mean, like Duke against North Carolina, I mean, Duke didn't foul a single time and held UNC to less than 70 points. I mean, the level of defense that Duke is playing right now, holding North Carolina to just 6 of 17 from 3, just 44% from the field, playing that level of defense and not fouling a single time, like that's Kara Lawson's signature written all over for it. You can't ask for a better, more perfect and pure defensive performance than that. So, you know, you're looking at Duke and they're kind of fighting their stride and getting hot at the right time, but also the job of the committee is to look at the entirety of a body of work. You can't get so caught up in what we saw this past weekend in a rivalry game although it happened, although it bears weight, we still have to look back at the beginning of the season where Duke was kind of sputtering just a little bit. So Duke at 10, we've got Iowa, TCU, Maryland, Michigan State at 14, Ole Miss at 15 after a big win over Tennessee on Tuesday night, and then Oklahoma at 16. Which teams stand out to you there?
Well, TCU, pay attention to them, because if they keep holding on to a hosting spot, there's probably a 50% chance that they're going to the Fort Worth Super Regional, and they would just sleep in their beds until and if they made the Final Four in Phoenix. And that's one of those things that to us as media members and to the fans and what have you, we notice that. The selection committee, though, it's not something they talk about. It's not something they care about. That's just a byproduct of the situation. Also want to point out two more SEC teams, Ole Miss and Oklahoma. I think, again, like you're always, when you're 15, 16, you're always just kind of like on that bubble of hosting when we talk about it. But the SEC schedule is brutal. It gives in for no one. We've seen so many coach crash outs in the past 2 weeks. And I think it really highlights how close all of this race is and why it matters. Like, you want to be hosting. I know Ole Miss last year had talked about finally wanting to host. It's been a long time. You need to do everything you can to hold on to that. And I believe both lost over the weekend. So maybe if the committee had done it this week, it'd be a little different.
Yeah, coach crash outs. That's like been the theme of college men's and women's basketball this past week. And we saw Coach Kim Caldwell totally blow off Coach Yo's handshake after Tennessee lost the other night. It's, you know, Kim Caldwell's feeling the heat just like every other coach in the SEC, I think, is feeling the heat. It's the heat of the SEC, the competitiveness of the SEC, the fact that on any given night, it doesn't matter if it's a top 25 ranked team or not, you could be vulnerable. It's also opportunity that if any of these teams, if an Oklahoma, if an Ole Miss, or any of these SEC teams on the outside looking in of the top 16, if they go on a run in the SEC tournament, thank you, they go on a run in the SEC tournament, well, then all bets are off. That could change everything with a run in one of the most competitive conferences. So it's a double-edged sword there. Cass, I loved this. This was so fun. I hope everybody learned something about it, because I can't wait for Selection Sunday. I'm going to feel like the smartest person in the room.
You got to bring this to Yahoo Sports Daily.
You better believe that I will. Hoping for some exciting Selection Sunday content. Yeah, Fitz. You know, you want to bring up quad wins? Oh, little do you know, they don't matter. But we're hoping to have some fun Selection Day content coming your way here on Yahoo Sports. We'll keep everybody updated with that. But Cass, let's transition into our Spotlight Player of the Week. We do it every single week. Who are you looking at? Who do you want to shout out in college basketball this week?
I went with the collective. I want to shout out Maryland, who is also in that top 16. They've had some season-ending injuries again this year, but the comeback kids, man, they tied the largest comeback in program history and the first road win over a top 10 team since 2022, came back against then number 8 Ohio State, 76-75. They were down 19. Huge win for them. The Big Ten is another bloated conference with a lot of teams competing for that top 16, but the tournament in general. So that positioning is going to matter. Who do you got?
So I have a long list. I'm feeling generous today. I know that kind of takes away from our Spotlight Player of the Week when we make that plural, but I do have to shout out Johnson & Johnson. Raven Johnson and Tessa Johnson and their performance at LSU on Saturday night. The first time ever that women's college basketball got a prime time slot on Saturday night on ESPN. So that was an awesome milestone for the crew. Holly Rowe was there. Rebecca Lobo was there. Ryan Rucco was there. And it couldn't have been, you know, one of the better rivalries that we have in this sport. Two teams and two coaches that I don't think like each other very much. And that always... has good theater attached to it. It was popping at the PMAC at LSU, but Raven Johnson and Tessa Johnson were absolutely outstanding. They combined for 40 points. Those two alone combined for more than a half of South Carolina's point total at LSU. 79-72 win over LSU. It was what they did offensively. What Raven Johnson is able to do defensively. She added 7 boards onto her stat line for the night. I mean, those two were absolutely unstoppable. And if you want to talk about Johnson's, Flauge Johnson. I know it was on the losing side of things, but Flauge was LSU's leading scorer by a long stretch, 21 points, 8 rebounds, a steal. You know, LSU had a great game plan against South Carolina, and Kim Mulkey has yet to beat Dawn Staley at LSU. Like, LSU and South Carolina is such a fun rivalry, but I think the South Carolina side of things are thinking, it's not really a rivalry to us. It feels like South Carolina is that, you know, that next dragon for Kim Mulkey to slay. That LSU fans are kind of feeling that impatience a little bit of wanting to take down South Carolina, kind of having that infinity stone in Kim Mulkey's collection. But South Carolina's defense was just far too much for LSU to handle. LSU actually out-rebounded South Carolina. They couldn't hit from three. They missed free throws. The gimmies just weren't there. And although I want to shout out Flauge, like, she was their leading scorer on the night, but Flauge missed 2 critical free throws. Can't be doing that. Can't be doing that. So, awesome game.
Raven Johnson's late-game execution, especially as you're talking about Flauge, that's all I could think about. Like, her late game execution multiple times for South Carolina this year is going to pay dividends in the tournament. Incredible growth from her as well. Like, when you see the ball in her hands late, you're feeling pretty good about South Carolina's chances.
100%. Her level of physicality and tenacity, even when you know that she is gassed toward the end of the game in the biggest moments, she steps up. And that's that experience factor that I think is so important for South Carolina. And she talks about, she's very open, honest about, you know, the criticism that she's received on social media and how that has made her kind of want to step away from the game a little bit. But she's been able to turn that around and use it as fuel. And you can tell, like, Raven Johnson, every single time she goes out on the court, plays like she's got something to prove. A little honorable mention for me. I wanted to shout out Danny Carnegie. 29-point performance, 8 rebounds, 3 assists, and a steal in a big-time 76-74 win over Vanderbilt. Now, Georgia's not a top 25 team, but Georgia is one of those teams in the SEC that if you don't give them your best shot, your best fight, like, Georgia can be a giant slayer. So big night for Danny Carnegie and a huge win for them.
Yeah, knocked Vanderbilt out of that 4 seed for the time being.
All comes back to bracketology. I mean, like, that's what every conversation we're going to have until, you know, mid-March will come back to bracketology. But the SEC has been a blast. If you can't tell from my player spotlights of the week, the SEC has been a blast to watch all season long, but especially recently. We've got plenty of games coming up. Of course, Unrivaled is in action Friday through Monday. We've also got Baylor at Texas Tech and a little Wednesday action. LSU heads to Ole Miss on Thursday. South Carolina goes to Alabama. Cass mentioned how UCLA has several big-time matchups. What did you say? 4 games in 7 days?
Ole Miss, yeah.
Whew. So something to watch for there. Washington and UCLA in a nice little Big Ten West Coast matchup, 10 o'clock Eastern time on Thursday. And Michigan and Iowa go head-to-head at noon on Sunday. Cass, what are you watching for in that game?
I'm watching for Michigan-Iowa. Iowa hasn't had the easiest stretch after that Taylor McCabe ACL injury, losing her. But Michigan, as we've talked about, is a team that could really make a lot of noise in March. They've had much more kind of signature performances than anything they could do against Iowa. But I think that'll be a good Big Ten matchup to watch, especially as UCLA has completely taken over the conference and basically wrapped up the regular season title.
Yeah. No doubt. We talked early in conference play of, you know, who can compete with UCLA in the Big Ten. The answer is nobody. But that second place spot might be incredibly valuable. We've also got Tennessee and Oklahoma, 2 o'clock Eastern time on Sunday. 2 teams that need it. You know, Oklahoma is kind of just grasping on to a top 16 ranking. You know that Tennessee is trying to get into that ranking. Kim Caldwell's starting to feel the heat a lot. So that's going to be a fascinating matchup to watch unfold as well. That's going to do it for us today. Thoughts? Questions on the selection process? Cass is an expert, a genius, and an insider on the entire process. So feel free to leave us a comment if you're watching on the Yahoo Sports YouTube page. But you can always listen to us on your preferred podcast platform as well. So let us know whatever you want to hear, any questions that you might have. Appreciate y'all as always for tuning in. If this is your first time, then welcome. If you are an every weeker, then thanks for coming back. Appreciate you. Make sure to tell your friends all about Hoops 360. We are back every single week, and we'll be right back here next week as well. For Cassandra Negley, I'm Caroline Fenton. We'll see you soon.